My name is Dana Takagi, and you know, during the meditation tonight, I realized something that was a little bit disappointing to me, which is that when I first came to sit here and study here, I was anxious, and I had a fair amount of kind of physical discomfort, and my mind was kind of restless. And, you know, I'm still that way. I think, you know, we all hope we could maybe get a little more better, like a little fixed, doing this practice. And it's kind of a good reminder for me, at least, that I have a lot of the same issues that I did before. So, you know, this is kind of a big holiday weekend. I just wanted to mention a couple of things about the holidays. First, I know you thought I was going to say Valentine's Day, right? No, I wasn't going to say that. This is, on Friday, is what we call Parinirvana Day, which is the death of the historical Buddha. And in the Mahayana tradition, we often mark this with a sesshin, or a retreat, a sit, which I'm sure Kathy will tell you about during the announcements. And even if you don't come and sit, this is a time all over the world where Buddhist practitioners give some thought to those who have died that they've loved, those who have died that they don't particularly love, our own deaths, our own impending, eventual, but very certain, for us, a death will come. And this is a kind of time of reflection. It's after you eat the chocolate on Valentine's Day. And the other, of course, you know that this is also what do we call it? President's Day on Monday. And also on the, is Monday the 19th? I think it is. Do I have that right? Tuesday?
18th.
Okay, so Tuesday is the 19th. Tuesday is something that some of you may know is what we call the Day of Remembrance, which is the day that President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. If you didn't know what an executive order is, you probably do now, because there's been a lot of executive orders that have come out of the White House. Anyway, this was an executive order that that created the kind of legal apparatus and the justifications for evacuating Japanese and Japanese Americans from the Pacific Coast. And you know, although we think of this as history, to me, it's not really history, because partly because my parents were interned, partly because it's an executive order, and the use of executive orders has a lot of arbitrary power attached to it. And also, you know, it happens that for Japanese and Japanese Americans that, you know, General John DeWitt, who was basically the architect of the concentration camps for Japanese during the Second World War, this happens today too, at a press conference where he was being asked about Executive Order 9066. There was a lot of discussion in the Justice Department about whether the federal government should make a distinction between Japanese Americans, on the one hand citizens, and their parents, who were aliens. And General DeWitt replied off camera, but mic on, a Jap is a Jap. And, you know, some other day I would like to talk more about kind of the long history of this and its impact on Buddhist practice for many of us, because basically this is our history, all of our history at this point. But I wanted to mention that February 19th is also intentionally a book launch for a new book called American Sutra. It's got a longer title. I don't know if I have it with me. American Sutra, World War II, Buddhism, and Japanese Americans. And it's really about the practice of Buddhism among kind of native practitioners inside the camps. And the author of this book, some of you might know his name. His name is Duncan Ryuken Williams. He's a professor of Buddhist studies at USC. And he's also an ordained priest. He was ordained in Japan. And I suspect it's a somewhat academic book, so I don't know. I mean, it's not out yet. I have it on pre-order. Duncan's other book was called The Other Side of Soto Zen. So he's very familiar with the lineage and the practice. And so it's a kind of an upside to the occasion of February 19th. Okay, I've already talked way longer on this intro than I've meant to talk, so... you know, last month I came in here and I talked about modesty as one of the virtues of Buddhist practice. And after that talk, we did a little bit of Q&A, and I didn't really check with this person, so I'm not necessarily going to name this person, but someone asked me whether or not it was okay to occasionally pat yourself on the back and say, hey, I did a good job. Was that something immodest or not? And I believe I said, sure, go ahead, do that. And I don't regret any of that exchange, but I have thought time and time again on that exchange since January. And I've thought about this because the person who happened to ask me that question, I've known for a long time. We have been co-practitioners. We have been on the board together. We have been in a very intensive and private leadership group that went through a series of very long meetings about kind of the transitions and changes in leadership at the Santa Cruz Zen Center. And so I know this person in the kind of deepest possible way. It's like going to couples therapy, but with all your friends or colleagues. I don't know. I won't name the people in the room that were part of this, but it was a very deep experience and we thought that in order for us to think about our relationship to Santa Cruz Zen Center, we had to show ourselves one to the other. And that often can be a very painful and, you know, kind of vulnerable place to do work. So anyway, long story short, I know this person. And the reason I thought again and again on this interaction was I thought, what does this person think that I know that they don't? And also vice versa, what is it that this person knows or doesn't seem to know that they think that I, for some reason, should know? Those are actually very similar, right? But it really was this... kind of, here I am, the same person who 20 years ago was anxious, couldn't sleep, had pain, had questions, and then went on this kind of long adventure in Zen. And anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about some of what I've been thinking about in response to that question. And basically what I want to talk about is, you know, we talk a lot about ordinary life and how Zen practice has a kind of parallel and kind of compatibility with ordinary everyday life outside a temple or a Zen center. And I want to try to put a little bit more kind of meaning on that. And but first let me... and I should also say, by way of introduction, that over this last period of time, while I've had a sitting practice, I often myself feel like I'm moving in a lot of different directions. I'm doing the meditations. I'm studying, reading texts, and Although it's been a little bit uneven of late, but doing Sangha practice or being a part of a Sangha community as well. And particularly with the study, I feel a little bit like I'm always running after something to catch up with myself, to learn that I still should run after something else. So for example, sometimes, you know, I've had this feeling like, oh, this is the right text to study. I should be studying this. Other people are studying this. And then I hear someone else, maybe from another Zen center or maybe from this one, say, well, now we're going to study this other text. And then I turn and go, I'm going to study that text too. And then I'm going to study all the texts behind it. And then, you know, not 5 minutes later, it's, well, what about that text? And it's been like that. Maybe you don't have this feeling, but I often feel like, can't the teachers just get it together and tell us what to read in order? And then I thought, oh, I guess I'm culpable in this as well. So I just want to start with a quick quote from a book that I've been reading called The Ways of Tenderness. Any of you familiar with this book? This is a book by Earthlin or Zenju Marceline Manuel. She's a student of Blanche Hartman's. And, you know, there are very few books that are written by people of color that are trained particularly in the Soto Zen tradition. And so this book is known for being her own kind of discovery process of herself and kind of intersectional, many different identities through Zen practice. Anyway, forgive me, Zenju, I'm not going to quote you. I'm going to quote the person who wrote the preface, which is a guy by the name of Charles Johnson. And he is opening his preface with a quote from a guy named Po Chu. And Po Chu wrote a text called The Non-Duality of Buddhahood and Ordinary Life. And I'll just tell you a really quick story about him in just a minute, but let me just read this quote. This is what Po Chu, the monk, says. Ordinary life and Buddhahood have no distinction. Great knowledge is not different from ignorance. Why should one seek outwardly for a treasure when the field of the body has its own bright jewel? So when I read this quote, the first thing I thought of is, I've never heard of him. How come I've never heard of him? So I had to go look him up and figure out who this guy was and where he fit in the Mahayana tradition. And this is, I'll just tell you, since I went through the trouble of looking this up, you know, when we do a Shuso or a head student ceremony, the Shuso always reads the first case of Bodhidharma meeting Emperor Wu, and Emperor Wu kind of blows the whole scene and Bodhidharma leaves. And Emperor Wu basically doesn't know who Bodhidharma is. So who does he ask? Po Chu. That's who this Po Chu is. And Po Chu says, man, you blew it. Are you kidding me? That was a real live, in the flesh, bodhisattva that was here. Anyway. So I feel a little bit like this, this quote kind of captures some of my own dilemmas that I've been feeling over the years with Zen practice. So tonight I want to talk about what I'm going to call verification, and what some Zen Buddhists have also called the verification of practice. And basically, what verification refers to, I mean, if I were to put it kind of maybe more simply, it would be to say, how do you know that Buddhism is true? How do you know that what you're doing here is doing something? I mean, I know lots of people say, oh, I'm much calmer. Or, oh, I didn't give that driver the finger on the way out of the zendo. Or something like that. So I know all of that. But kind of maybe in the grandest sense, how do you know that Buddhism is true in your life? And what does it feel like? How does it, how are you sensing it? And what are the signs of verifying that the practice of sitting or studying or being, doing Sangha work, is what Catherine, when she was abbot here, called the truth of this life. This really ordinary life. And where in this, as Po Chu says, the body jewel, does this take place? So I'll be kind of quick about this. There are various strands of discussions about practice and verification, and there are two basic sources, and I won't go into detail about either one of these except to mention them by name. One is comes from a sutra, a very old one from the Pali Canon called the Kalama Sutta. Maybe some of you have heard of this. It's a kind of exchange and discussion between the Kalama people and the Buddha. And then the other discussion of practice verification, and or major one, I should say, comes from, and it's like an official Soto Zen publication that appears in 1890, so well after the death of Dogen Zenji, and it's meant to be a kind of compilation and kind of reading, interpretation, discussion of this set of writings that are known as the Shobogenzo. So I'll just give you kind of a preview of the answer, or what I'm going to suggest, or move in the direction of, and that is that this is not a one-size-fits-all practice. We often act as if everybody should do the same thing at the same time, sit the same amount, study the same text, and so on. And there is some merit to that, I think, and at a very grand level. But it's also the case that your own verification of practice is located in your own body, mind, heart. And so logically, necessarily, that's not the person sitting next to you. So mine is not Ken's. Ken's is not Edie's. Edie's is not Michael's, and so on. And, you know, this is a really hard part for me of practice because personally, I like to look to external sources of wisdom. Right? I came to this practice because I felt like I was unreliable or I was unsure. And there was a kind of level of uncertainty there. So what we know through these texts, is actually, it's kind of interesting in a kind of nerdy Buddhist kind of way. I'll just kind of mention briefly the Kalama Sutta. So the Kalama people have this occasion to have a dialogue with the Buddha, and they say, you know, some teachers say this, and some teachers say that, and then other teachers say this other thing. Who is right? How should we judge? And the Buddha, in response, gives does three things. One, he kind of lays out why you should not trust teachers alone, why you should not trust rational thought alone, why you should not just say, I feel like it's this, I'm pretty sure that's it, why you should not resort to your own opinion. Sometimes the Kalama Sutta is also known as the Dharma of Free Inquiry. The Dharma of Free Inquiry is where I say, nah, Ken, I'm sure it's this. And Ken says, no, it's actually this. And then we have this debate without having any kind of real discussion of either method of discovery or verification of discovery. So after the Buddha kind of instructs the monks in Kalama who are he's giving them basically assurances about this process. He says, first, you know, you have to take away all of these basically biased kinds of arguments and presentations that you hear. And of course, I immediately thought, oh, this is like CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, or PBS, right? Which one is true? And how should I make that judgment? What the Buddha then does is he's talking to the Kalama people, he says, not only should you not do the following things, for example, rely just on teachers, But you need to have a verification process, and that verification process, I think he doesn't call it a verification process, but he talks about our own individual work with greed, hate, and delusion. And he goes through this somewhat logical discussion in which he says, you know, when you are free of greed, hate, and delusion, even if someone is doing evil and nothing bad happens to them, and I'm not talking about any contemporary examples here, even though an evildoer doesn't have consequences for doing evil, you are abiding in being free of greed, hate, and delusion. So he tries to, in some ways, instruct the Kalama monks about making the distinction between the consequences of actions and the quality of feeling in the spirit, the mind, and the body of being free from greed, hate, and delusion. And there's a second part of the, or a third part, rather, where he talks about other forms of verification, and in particular he says, you'll know that something is true by the effect that it produces in others. And I'm just going to kind of bracket this just for a moment, because I think this is a very kind of complicated way for us to understand whether or not we do good deeds or are free from greed, hate, and delusion, kind of working with this dual body, and it shows up in the world. Because just, you know, in the previous discussion with the Kalama monks, he says it may or may not show up in the world. And it reminded me actually of one of the, I think, kind of misconceptions about Buddhist practice in the West, which is that many of us have a kind of utopian wish for peace and harmony, right? And that we, that, you know, the perfection of our own wisdom in the sense body is expressed in ultimately peace and harmony. And, you know, I personally have questions about that. I think this is a kind of long haul, and I, you know, I think it's important in my mind to have kind of a plan B view on this. And I'll just mention briefly and kind of not go into detail on it. I've been listening to podcasts. Have any of you heard or know of the podcast with Krista Tippett called On Being? It's actually a really lovely set of interviews that she does with religious leaders. For example, she's interviewed Thich Nhat Hanh, Joan Halifax of Upaya Zen Center, Robert Thurman, and then she interviews novelists and writers. And she recently, about 2 weeks ago, interviewed someone called Cynthia Rankin. And have you heard of Cynthia Rankin? She's, you've probably read something by her. She's an essayist and poet and novelist and columnist. And a couple of years ago, I don't know if any of you remember this rally called Unite the Right, in which a young woman was killed by a car that sort of mowed through the crowd. It was a kind of, you know, ultra-right, racist, xenophobic demonstration around kind of the purity of the white race. And and a kind of bringing together of different elements of the right wing. And Cynthia Rankin, I think maybe that week in the New York Times, had a kind of amazing op-ed that was called The Condition of Life for Black Americans is Mourning. And it was an incredible essay that was not so much partisan as it was trying to explicate the conditions of race relations in the United States. Anyway, Krista Tippett interviewed Cynthia Rankin recently, and they had this kind of long, winding conversation about lots of different things. And Cynthia, the title of the podcast is called "How Can I Say This So That We Can Both Stay in This Car Together?" And it wasn't about kind of resolving a conflict. It was about opening a conversation. And Professor Rankin recounted an exchange that she had with a driver who had been sent to pick her up to take her to a graduation in the Berkshires, where she was the featured speaker. And the it usually wouldn't be my first question, but apparently Professor Rankin said, "Who'd you vote for?" And the driver said, "I voted for Trump." And then they got into this conversation about why the driver voted for Trump. And she explained that it had to do with her perception of Obamacare, and, the rates went up. And then I think Professor Rankin changed the subject and started to talk about some other things. And it turned out that the driver lived in a double wide. Does everybody know what a double wide is? Mm-hmm. Well, this will tell you something about Cynthia Rankin. She didn't know what a double wide was. And she was too embarrassed to admit that she did not know what a double wide trailer was. I mean, I should say Cynthia Rankin teaches at Yale and went to, elite private universities for her undergrad and graduate education. She didn't want to admit that she didn't know what a double wide was. And the driver was recounting how, normally during the summer, she would leave her house and go visit her sister somewhere else, but there was a problem with the double wide, and there was a crack in it that had to be repaired. So she was going to work overtime and, two, three jobs to try to make the money to do this double wide and fix the double wide. And Professor Rankin said, "Well, so how much is that?" And the driver said, "It's $300. And maybe you might not know this, but when someone is brought in from the outside to do a speaking engagement for a graduation, they're paid quite a lot of money. Way more than $300. And so Professor Rankin is sort of recounting, what should I do? I could just give her the money, because it's not that big a deal for her. Or what? What to do? Well, how to kind of reach across this big divide here. And she ends up not giving her the money, but what she says is that we opened a conversation. Even though this woman, the next time she goes to the polls, is probably going to vote against anything that has to do with my interests. And it was a, kind of really nice example, I think, of maybe the possibilities. But I digress. I want to come back to the sitting, study, sangha practice and say that, we're taught and we follow the admonition to just sit. And I think, in my view, the truth of what happens for us is that we're waiting. We're observing and we're waiting for something to happen. And I think a lot for each of us has our own kind of very individual karmic history. And whether it is that, like me, you have great anxiety, or you have depression, or you have any number of other things that you think you need to work on, these things lodge in the body. And to the extent that we're able to be conscious of the emotions that attach to these things that are lodged in the body, whether it be anger, fear, even joy, apprehension, a lot of the kind of afflictive emotions that we have that we're trying to work with, one of the things that we try to do is stay with this trouble in the body. And for most of us, I think, and, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say. For me, typically I like to get away from my stuff. I mean, yeah, I sit. But I feel like it's sort of normal for me to want to get away from it or step away from it and fix it. And then after decades pass, fix it already, because I've been working on it for a long time. So I'll just kind of circle back and then say that these things, you know, this is one of the more infamous Suzuki Roshi sayings, that these things that you have right now, make friends with them, because you're going to have them forever, right? Make friends with them. Or maybe not make friends with them, but get to know it. And I'll just say one last thing, which is really not in any way part of the Buddhist canon, but it has been certainly my experience in this, which is that for me, stillness and silence has allowed me to recognize some things in me that have been very long-term, difficult things. But it has not always been the case that stillness and silence allow me to move that thing. And for me personally, I've done a lot of other different practices to try to kind of move the stuck places out of my body. I mean, I think when we cry, that's one of the things that, have you ever cried and then felt better after you cried? Or laughed hysterically and then felt better? I mean, I think, to me, it's not the laughing or the crying. It is that it allows something to flow where it was stuck. So, you know, I feel like I'm getting a little woo-woo out there, and I'm not really intending to do this, but I just wanted to say that, you know, in this practice, we often expect that, you know, the sitting or the study or the sitting and the study or the sitting and the study and then and the service work comes together in some way. And I want to kind of just step back for a moment and say that the externalities that we seek, whether it be in texts or even maybe after, you know, wanting to sit more and more, that these don't work. It's really your body, your junk, your awareness, which is different from everyone else's awareness. And we try our best not to, as we're doing this, studying the self, to make a mess for other people. But sometimes we do. But really the onus of responsibility for studying the self, I would say it's mostly yours and mostly mine. And these are very separate things, you know, so that, and this is part of the reason that, you know, communication sometimes is difficult, and why last month in this exchange after I talked about modesty, I think I felt like I wasn't quite sure I had connected adequately with the person who asked the question. So why don't I stop there and, you know, whenever I talk, I never have a good sense if it really kind of goes through. So, would you like to have some questions or not? Yarl.
And so, coming back to that, what was it that you wished you had said? Or what would have completed the...
Oh, with the person last week or last month?
Coming back, what was it you were thinking about?
Two things. One is I, if I could do over, I would say, hey, this is for you, but only because I know you so well, I'm going to say it's great for you to pat yourself on the back sometimes, but also what is it in you that thinks that you have to ask me? So that's one thing. And the other thing, to the rest of the sangha, I would have said, and don't think this applies to you. Right? Don't think this applies to you. And we're not working at the general level here. We're working on a relationship I've had with someone for over 20 years. Does that answer? Yeah. Thank you for asking. Anybody else? Liz. Thank you. One of these, I don't have them, but I'll bring some, you know, like little, what do you call them? Like postcards for the book. I think it's, the author is doing quite a book tour to mostly Jodo Shinshu temples and, but he, you know, like any author, he would like for as many people to read and be aware of his work as possible. Rev?
It is individual. It is personal. We do each negotiate away in our own minds and bodies. And yet we have a canon. We have shared practice, we have precepts, we have guidance. So how to rectify the two in your own experience?
You mean to make it work?
Well, yeah, I mean, because while it is ultimately completely individual, it's also pretty darn hard and lonely if we're always feeling like we have to work everything through for ourselves, and sometimes it can feel helpful, maybe delusory, but helpful.
Yes.
To have some kind of sense of something to organize around.
Yes. So, in the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha says you should verify with a trusted teacher. And I would add to that a trusted friend, a spiritual friend. Maybe.
Even though one of the other guidances is don't trust the teacher.
Right.
So it's like a composite of all of those. It's like not just this, not just this, and not just this, but there's some value.
Well, you know, you have to figure the Buddha was speaking to a group of monks who were already fairly deep into practice. So, you know, you wouldn't say to a group at large who are not already together practicing, yeah, just kind of do it yourself and try not to, yeah, and check in with somebody every now and then. I do think, you know, there are many, many commentaries on this sutta, and one of them is hopefully people are wise, have the wisdom to pick a good teacher or a good spiritual friend. And some of us actually might even check with several friends and teachers. That's called science. To, you know, get different samples of responses. And then I will also say that sometimes as someone else works with their stuff, it becomes, as it's known or is part of Sangha life, is problematic for another person. And that's where I'll just go back and say modesty is really important.
And in this context, how would you define modesty?
I would say we don't know.
To allow ourselves to not know.
Yeah.
To not be so certain and so quick to think that we have to
We don't know.
Push in. And
yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as part of the kind of Western psyche around Buddhism is that we have to fix it. We have to fix it tomorrow, if not yesterday. And we hope that everybody will get along all the time. And, you know, we are individual beings, but we're also individual beings that are part of a society that has a long history with a long array of long list of conflicts and problems that we carry ourselves. So I think, personally, I think, you know, utopianism is kind of out of the question. Like, you pick any of the hot button issues, and we're going to find them amongst us as well, I think. I see Ziggy trying to talk here. Thank you, Kathy. Is that...
so transparent. What do you think about this notion that we might be evolving spiritually or psychologically as a human race, or... this idea that we're just always going to be back to greed, hate, and delusion. I mean, that self-awareness with the kind of tools of modern times of psychotherapy or all the wisdom traditions offering so much in the way of teaching us how to navigate our afflictive emotions and, you know, how to bridge some of the divides that are going on. Are we moving?
Maybe. I mean, certainly there's much more awareness of and kind of call to do some kind of interrogation of this one. That's not just the domain of Buddhism. That's really other religions and other kind of, you know, much more secularized version of that. I mean, when I first started to sit and I would tell people that I thought I was becoming a Buddhist, they go, yeah, whatever. What is that? Is that yoga? And very few people now would say that, I think. I mean, I think there's a much more, a higher level of information. Are we evolving? I don't know. What do you think? Are we evolving? You mean like towards some sort of more enlightened?
I'd like to hope that that's the case because I think there's so much pushback. And I think, you know, it's kind of a, for every step forward or for every sense of momentum that might be true, there's a contraction that's going on at the same time, an othering and a separating, rather than the sense of no separation or all the things that come here to understand in ourselves better.
I think I would just add that I think it's probably different for different classes and groups in society. In this podcast that I listened to, Krista Tippett at one moment said, well, what do you think about, you know, that things were getting better? And Professor Rankin goes, wait a minute. I never said that with respect to certain things having to do with blackness. We thought, maybe, but we were wrong, is what she said. Now, whether you agree with that or not doesn't matter, but it just shows you that I think... for some people, things have not gotten better. I think for many people that are anxious about money, the economy, the future, particularly industrialized jobs, I think that anxiety has deepened. But this is Dana, the sociologist, not... Yeah. Thank you, Ziggy. Liz.
When you were mentioning about the Sangha life, we're all kind of, we're all turbulent beings and we come together and we interact. Sometimes it feels like being together in service is kind of a low risk way to experience
that we know these different people are coming together with good intentions, but we can hear that we don't always harmonize so easily. And sometimes you can feel in the course of a service that there's a little more harmony and effort extended to try to bring the voices together. But if it doesn't quite come together, it's like, well, that was just one morning, and then there's a lot of other mornings, you know,
It sounds like you're talking about chanting.
Yeah.
Or are you talking about, like, chanting as a metaphor for...
Yeah. It's, for me, it's been kind of a way to feel safety in our... We are different, and we're going through different things at different times, and struggling with things, and yet we come together. So it's... over time, I felt like even if the chanting doesn't come together, I feel the underneath together.
Thank you. It's 7:25. Should we get outside? Or get outside and come inside and say hello?
That sounds good.
Very good. Thank you all very much.